This is the Afternoon Drive Podcast with Philip and Skip from KMJ and KMJNow.com.
3:04 on your Afternoon Drive. Hour 2 underway. This is News Talk 580 and 105.9 KMJ. That's Skip Echeverria. I'm Philip Teresi. And I think that we are both a little surprised by a Supreme Court ruling that came down today. This was the Supreme Court has concluded that a former Georgia police sergeant by the name of Nathan Van Buren could not be convicted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for misusing the police database to which he had access in the course of his duties as a one-time Georgia police sergeant. Follow me through this. This is a 6-3 split. The decision authored by Justice Barrett. In case you're scratching your head for just a second, as in Amy Coney Barrett, a woman. That is relevant here.
Mm-hmm.
In part.
Mm-hmm.
Van Buren was charged in 2015 with having misused this database under the terms of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. They came to the conclusion that he could not be convicted under these terms because the information that he accessed was available to him as a part of his job. Barrett writing, quote, "This provision covers those who obtain information from particular areas in the computer, files, folders, or databases, to which their computer access does not extend. It does not cover those who, like Van Buren, have improper motives for obtaining information that is otherwise available to them."
So three of the court's conservative justices dissented, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. Van Buren's attorney, Jeffrey Fisher, welcomed the ruling, of course, and said that the computer fraud law is now restricted to its proper reach.
So the law that we're talking about is the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. This law was specifically written to target hacking and computer crimes of that nature. And the law prohibits accessing a computer without authorization and exceeding authorized access. So, for instance, if I have a computer on my desk in my office, to which I am the only person assigned access to that computer because I have privileged information about building engineering or bookkeeping or whatever, and you come in and sit down at my computer and start using that computer without permission, you're technically in violation of this law. If you're on your computer in your office and you start plinking around on the network and somehow find your way into the boss's computer and are able to open up files to which you were not given permission, like accounting or contracts or something like that, you're in violation of this law. Now you add in privilege escalation and all of the little nuanced things that go into hacking, and you start to get this bigger and bigger thing. But if you are a member of the business office team and you have permission to access the accounting files and the contract files, and you go in and read my contract, you have not violated this law.
Oh, see, and that's the part where I feel like the law is not up to date with the fact that otherwise privileged information is readily available on computer systems. Because I look at it in terms of some of the laws and ethics around accessing a medical files. And I know that medical information is a little different. But let's say I work in a practice and they have files, paper files, and there's somebody that I recognize in the practice. And I'm like, oh, I wonder why Philip came in to see the shrink.
Mm-hmm.
I have access to the files.
Sure you do.
But ethically and morally, ethically, I mean, you could even argue that that would be grounds for having some sort of write-up. I'm not supposed to go and read your file just because I have access to it.
Of course.
And I feel like that's in this situation, because not only did the individual access the information that he had available, also used it. I mean, like, it wasn't just a, ooh, I wonder what Cindy's up to. I mean, this was somebody who violated, if nothing else, a code, as I would understand a police officer would have to take about, you know, morals and ethics.
So here's the thing. If we were just talking about a cop who looked up the, you know, contact information of his best friend in high school or his college girlfriend, and that was where it began and ended. Look to see where Cindy Lou Who moved after 1993. Google searched her house. Oh, looks like she's in a nice place. Good for her. Off we go. That's a little icky, but I don't consider it to be this horrible, grotesque breach of trust because the information's not going anywhere. Van Buren, a police officer, while suffering financial difficulties, hit up an acquaintance for money. That acquaintance alerted law enforcement authorities. So there was already something funky going on, because I've had people ask me for money. It's never crossed my mind to like call their boss or call the cops and be like, yo, this dude's looking for cash. The FBI puts together a sting. And this acquaintance offers Van Buren money to run a search for a license plate on the law enforcement database, claiming that he wanted to find out if a local stripper was an undercover cop.
And then the local man gave Van Buren $6,000 and he did the search. So a jury convicted him in 2017 of violating the computer fraud law and a separate count of honest services fraud. The Atlanta-based 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in 2019 upheld the computer fraud conviction but ordered a retrial on the other charge. This, to me, though, what stops other shady folks or maybe, you know, people in a position with the access of being, you know, I need a little extra money. I have access. Like, how you can turn this into a side hustle. It's not illegal.
That's what the honest services fraud charge should cover. There needs to be a change made to computer privacy laws because it is a very easy thing. And I'll tell you right now that it's going to be an uphill fight because there's a whole lot of data brokers, Facebook, Twitter, White Pages, Spokio, all these little shady websites that have all your data floating around. There needs to be a change in the law that says if you are going out and digging into somebody's confidential information, non-public information, with the intent of profiting by sharing, disseminating, or otherwise meting out that information, that you either have to have the explicit permission of the person whose information you're sharing or that you be fined until you are crumbling to dust.
Well, so the guy's not going to get in trouble for this. It's been overturned.
Yeah.
My guess is that, I mean, he's still good luck getting a job in law enforcement after this.
Yeah.
You would think, I would hope. So I want to point to the fact, because this is interesting, because the three conservative appointees to the court that the president, President Trump appointed, were joined by the three liberal justices in the ruling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some interesting interpretations and alignments of individuals on that court.
The evolution of the Supreme Court has been something to behold.
Well, and what the reason why I wanted to bring that up is because there have been a couple 9-0 rulings in the last couple of weeks, and it has made some folks scratch their heads in terms of, I mean, it's everything from like immigration rights to, I mean, it's all over the place. They've been busy the last couple of weeks. And the reason why I bring it up is that there's been, you know, conversations back and forth about the impact that President Trump had on the long term like trajectory of the Supreme Court. There's also the arguments of folks saying that, you know, maybe you should add more people if it's super conservative leaning, whatever. I like seeing this kind of, how do I put it? Teamwork, I guess, or ability to, we worried about this and to have talked about this, like the Supreme Court is not a political tool to be able to enforce things your way over the other way. It's actually about the law. I don't like this ruling. I hope that it turns into reevaluating the law, because I think that the guy got off on a technicality here. But that's what the Supreme Court is supposed to do, right? Look at the law.
Well, and that's exactly it. The role of the Supreme Court is to give a truly final ruling on what it is that the law states, what it is that the law orders be done. Ideally, that's it. That's the scope. This is what the law says. Unfortunately, frequently you get a little bit of activism from the bench, although the Supreme Court, because of their lifetime tenures and because of the level of scrutiny that they're subjected to, I think that that has somewhat of a moderating influence. At the same time, it's a lifetime appointment. So if you want to go hog wild, you've got the ability to just render whatever decision you want. There's no pulling you off. I mean, I'm sure there's some impeachment process somewhere, but I think we've got an interesting mix. And I think that some of the anxiety about the folks that Trump put on the Supreme Court, the only one that I'm still a little weary of, while ideologically some of the things that Amy Comey Barrett has said gives me pause. She's a really, really good judge. She was an amazing young lawyer. She loves the law. And if she's a Catholic, she's got an understanding of, you know, rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's, that is going to allow her to continue to be a truly faithful Catholic and also an objective justice. I got to be honest, though, there's something about Kavanaugh, man. The amount of anger, the sense of entitlement during his confirmation hearing and his meltdown as they were kind of winding down the Christine Blasey Ford thing.
All I'm saying is if Justice Barrett would have done that, she wouldn't have been approved.
And I don't think Kavanaugh should have been either. I don't know that the man has the temperament for the job. But he's got it. And fortunately, there's 8 other justices who I think are more even keeled to help balance that out.
Maybe he shouldn't be so emotional.
Like a woman, get it?
It's a new era in news talk. Only on News Talk 580 1059 KMJ.
If you miss any part of the show, you can get the podcast available at kmjnow.com. That's Philip. I'm Skip. We've been covering the story that's been going around about efforts to try and unionize at Clovis Unified. A lot of this tied to the fact that Clovis Unified was one of the first schools back as the pandemic was still trying to figure out a couple of things. And folks have been saying, like, this is one of, if not the biggest school district that does not have a union. Yeah. And is it time for that? We took a lot of calls on it, both sides, folks that had worked at Clovis and loved it and didn't feel like that it needed to happen. Some that said it's absolutely being shut down. And I think you and I made a wager on it. I got to figure out what the timeline was on if it was going to happen or not. So I will look that up in my file. But we do have an update.
It's not really an update. I think it's evidence that the pro-union group, Association of Clovis Educators, is realizing that they don't have the support of the bulk of the faculty body. So now we're going for the Hail Mary court filings to try and throw a wrench in what has been happening at Clovis Unified.
Right, because at the time they had put out a letter and they had a couple of quotes from individuals and were trying to get a certain number of signatures.
Yeah, well, now the Association of Clovis Educators, which I think is really just five people, and really only three of them are involved in this thing, they're making a claim that the Clovis Unified Faculty Senate, which is the current employee representation organization, so not a union, a faculty senate, that this violates state labor law because the faculty senate uses district resources and may be supported in part by district leadership. Therefore, the faculty senate undermines educator voices. And the Association of Clovis Educators said in a statement that this legal complaint that they have now filed was intended to safeguard students and educators and ensure educators have a real and independent voice in future decisions that impact schools.
This goes back to a ruling that was back in 1983 because there have been attempts to unionize in the past. However, the 1983 ruling, it did order that Clovis Unified would stop supporting Faculty Senate financially and to stop exclusively meeting with Faculty Senate as the only labor representation group. The a leader of ACE, this was a name that had popped up, Kristen
Heimerdinger.
Thank you. A teacher at Buchanan said, "We are concerned that Clovis Unified's administration's control of the Faculty Senate is not only illegal, but undermines the ability of Clovis educators to successfully advocate for improvements that students deserve."
Now, I want to thank Daniel Gligich over at SJV Sun for doing the footwork on this, because this filing goes on for 10,000 boring words. And he really boils it down here, saying ACE also claims the district is breaking state law by administering the Faculty Senate's elections, supporting the group financially, providing office space and professional services. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been a member of a couple of different unions. My experience with the unions has been that when relationships are good, the employer will allow for union activity to take place on company property. And when things start getting terse and weird, that's why we have a union hall. Not to say that management's going out and buying the coffee and the donuts and making sure everybody has a comfortable chair. But if the union steward's going to run around and talk to people, they're not going to make a ruckus if you keep it to your work, to your break time. The Faculty Senate is not a union. It has no obligation to operate under the same rules as a union. And that's where I'm a little dubious on the PERB ruling. Although they say that the Clovis Unified School District established the Faculty Senate to undermine another unionization effort, the Clovis Unified Teachers Association. Has anybody asked the teachers?
Well, I think the asking of the teachers has to do with if they're getting the signatures that they're looking for, because ACE needs to get 50% plus one. And it doesn't seem like they're on track to be able to do that by the end of the year. So are you going to get the support of the teachers? Well, I would like to offer the bit of information that the Clovis Unified Board of Trustees gave teachers a $4,000 one-time bonus from the money it received from federal COVID-19 stimulus funds, and that Freudian slip, and that teachers across the board, you do have the vocal people that are saying they weren't ready to go back. Many people are very proud to work in Clovis and have gone back. So are you going to get the 50% plus one? They does not look like it's on track to meet those numbers.
Do I agree that the Faculty Senate is impeding ACE's ability to get their 50% plus one? Yeah, but not by going out and willfully undermining ACE. The Faculty Senate is accomplishing it by meeting the needs of the educators in the district at a level that leaves less than 50% interested in participating in a unionization effort. I feel like somebody needs to suggest to the people from the so-called Association of Clovis Educators that somebody needs to just sit down and explain to them the concept of, if it ain't broke, stop trying to fix it.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
This is the Afternoon Drive Podcast with Philip and Skip from KMJ and KMJNow.com.
3:36 on KMJ. Good afternoon. I'm Philip Teresi. That's Skip Echeverria. The Clovis Unified School District being sued by a would-be teachers union, claiming that the Faculty Senate, which has been a part of the Clovis Unified School District since, I believe, the 1970s. According to the would-be union, the Faculty Senate is being operated illegally and in violation of a court order from 1983. Actually, it wasn't even a court order. It was a PERB order that sided with the now non-existent Clovis Unified Teachers Association, yet another effort to unionize Clovis. I think, I believe that if Clovis Unified is in violation with if Clovis Unified's in violation of some actionable element of the Public Employment Relations Board or California law, they need to get into compliance with that simply to cover their butts, just as a matter of maintaining the standards to which they hold to which the community holds them. I think that we're going to see more lawsuits from the Association of Clovis Educators claiming that everybody from the Faculty Senate to the statue of Lefty outside of the EECU ATM in Old Town Clovis is interfering with the unionization of Clovis Unified. Dude, we talked about this, what, 6 months ago? How many Clovis Unified teachers did we talk to? Were any of them interested in unionizing?
I think we only took a couple of calls where people had said that this had been an attempt for a while. And in fact, a representative from Clovis Unified did note that the district has a history of high rates of teacher satisfaction and student performance and has utilized respectful decision making to benefit students and staff. They have said they're not afraid of these allegations. They'll exercise their right to respond through the appropriate procedures. That, to me, says Clovis is feeling okay, that they're not in any hot water. Now, it does not surprise me that this comes up because Clovis is one of the biggest school districts without a union. I also think that the reason why folks could kind of rock the boat a little bit was because of the pandemic and the fact that Clovis didn't have Clovis teachers, some of them did not have the same support that they saw happening in like Fresno Unified, Central Unified. So the timing aligns with that.
The two districts that you just named are such an important part of this, though, man. Because we don't exist in a community where there is a monopoly on educational options. Not from the student side, not from the instructor side. But between the way California law works and the cooperation between the three dominant districts in the Fresno-Clovis metro, if you don't like the school district or the school that your child was assigned to, the paperwork takes a minute and you can get your kid sent to the school right by your office, right by your wife's office, whatever. Here's the other thing. If you're a teacher and you feel like you're not being represented or you're not being heard as an unrepresented labor unit, we got two unionized school districts here in town. If the people who work in Clovis were not satisfied with their job situation, there has not ever been a better time to switch districts and get unionized.
Right, exactly. And I think that we're going to see some of that because we talked about this over the last couple of months. As many as one third of teachers that responded to one survey said that they were considering a job change, meaning they were going to get out of teaching or pursue something else. So there are going to be opportunities to make those changes. Now, does that come with sacrifice? Possibly it's starting out on the, you know, low man on the pay scale or whatever, having to build your way up. Absolutely. But I think that if you're looking around at your peers and you're not getting the support, that does not mean that you don't need to find a union you could go be a part of. It's not surprising to me, though, that Clovis is pushing back on that or finding that they don't necessarily want or need it. If the allegations of trying to, you know, illegally squash an attempt at unionization are true and they can prove that, then by all means, hold them accountable.
But that's not what's happening. What's happening is you've got a market that is rich with opportunity for anybody who prefers working under the veil of protection one might suggest is afforded by a union. You've got a faculty senate that just got these teachers $4,000 bonuses for the extra work that they had to do and the extra hours they had to put in as a result of the pandemic. Maybe people just don't want to unionize. I mean, right now, honestly, if somebody came through the door, Appleton's going to kick me for even saying it. Right now, if somebody came through the door here at Radio City and was like, hey, we're going to try and organize. We're going to try and do a thing here. We want to make sure that, you know, everybody's being represented appropriately to management. They couldn't get support from the broadcast employees. I mean, look, I may be speaking out of turn, and I can't pretend to know what's in the hearts and minds of everybody on the third floor at Radio City. If we were talking about some of the other management groups in this region's broadcast environment, hell yeah, I'd unionize. Oh my God, you guys, once upon a time, they asked me to wake up at midnight to pre-record one show in Fresno, then drive to Modesto to produce another show, and then to stay and do part of a show live and pre-record the rest of it in Modesto before driving back to Fresno to start the workday over again. And they told me that $24,900 a year was generous.
How many people have been paid in trade to restaurants that closed?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, How many people are still owed talent fees by restaurants that closed? Looking at you, Agave Grill. Sometimes you've got a good situation. You're not going to rock the boat. There's no such thing as a perfect workplace. Mm-hmm. It does not exist. For instance, here at Radio City, They treat us very well. I find the pay to be extremely competitive. The benefits are on par with any professional level benefits that you could have access to. The facilities are reasonably well cared for. And the work environment, the people that we work with, are all, it's a pretty even-keeled group of people. But the coffee sucks. It's so bad.
It's so bad. Just so, so very bad.
But I'm not going to unionize for coffee. I'm just going to keep the Keurig in my office.
Right. And you have to be honest. For what sucks about the coffee, the vending machine choices are amazing.
I'm so trying to talk that guy into putting cigarettes and pint bottles in there.
If now, I mean, if there was ever a time to do it, it would be now because, you know, the building's half empty.
Look, I
know. Just be like, how did that get in there?
Look, I'm sure there must be laws because it's theoretically accessible to people under the age of 21. But I don't think there's anybody under 21 who works here right now.
I don't think so. Like, and you have to be vaccinated to come, well, to visit.
First of all, to even visit, yeah, you got to be vaxxed. But even in normal times, you don't just get to walk around the building. Nobody's kids are just like running up and down the halls. We've got one person who works on the third floor. She might actually be, and I'm not saying this like as flattery. I mean, she literally might be the smartest person in the building. She's got a degree in like molecular biology. Sydney. You hear her on the Kiss Country Morning Show.
Oh, I had no.
She's been helping out.
Meet anybody? Charlie and Jody. Anymore. Okay.
Yeah, you'll recognize Sydney when you see her because she looks like she's 12. She's actually like I think she's like 23 or 24 now.
Okay, so if we wanted to put your booze in the vending machine, it'd be okay.
But that's what I'm saying is there's nobody here under 21. I think sticking booze in the vending machine like Jack Daniels and cigarettes. I'm not saying for every day.
Isn't there like a rule in the contracts you're not supposed to be drunk or high on the air?
No, not on the air, just on the commercial breaks.
See, this is pointing back to the previous story about the Supreme Court. It's all in the wording. Coming up on 4 o'clock, if you've missed any part of the show up until now, you can get the podcast at kmjnow.com. That's also where you can get information on vaccinations if you want to add your name to the list and possibly to the drawing, you know, that California is doing for vaccinated folks. Kmjnow.com to find out where you can get your COVID vaccinations. So there was a story in the news a couple of weeks ago, and it was just... It was gross. It was in early April when a dependent adult was on a Fresno bus near Ventura and First, and a suspect, a 38-year-old by the name of Andrew Garcia, assaulted the gentleman that was riding the bus or the individual riding the bus, and it was all caught on video.
Yeah.
They still have not found this man despite having video and a positive identification in terms
an affirmative identification. Yeah. They know who this guy is. So what happened was April 6th of this year, 38-year-old suspect Andrew Garcia assaulted a man named Nicholas Gilbreth on fax bus number 1720 at 2240 hours near Ventura and First. A citizen who was friends with the victim has donated $2,000 to add on to the Valley Crime Stoppers reward, which was already at $1,000. So the reward now for information leading to the arrest of 38-year-old Andrew Garcia is now $3,000, and you can tip anonymously at 498-STOP.
Oh, my. Philip, I just looked up Nicholas Gilbreth because the name rang a bell. If this is the same person, we were in high school together.
Oh.
And he was just like the sweetest, most awesome young man. He used to tell us, use a gun and you're done.
Okay.
He would just like tell us like our different PSAs and stuff. We all had health class together.
So what you're saying is
this horrible things like that.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, Nicholas is not possessed of the ability to cause serious offense to a self-possessed adult.
No, just a sweet guy, like making his way through like life. You know, when we talk about like trying to have people be involved in, and I am 99.9% sure that's the same guy. He's just like riding along on the bus, getting from point A to point B. That's what we want to do with, you know, having people be involved in our communities, people that are all over the place in terms of, you know, like mental abilities, where they might be in terms of diagnosis or on a spectrum or abilities to contribute. Like, and as a parent, you just want your kid, as they become an adult, to be able to go and do adult independent things. I'm going to hunt you down.
So Garcia is a Hispanic male, 5'6". They give his age variously as 36 or 38. Hispanic male, 5'6", 200 pounds. So he's thick. Long, wavy, dark brown hair, parted in the middle, wearing a mustache and beard. Last seen wearing a gray t-shirt and black Nike shorts and shoes. His tattoos include a dog collar with spikes around his neck, the name Ashley on the left side of his neck, and a naked woman on his left arm, which he apparently is in the habit of covering with a sleeve of some sort, even when he's wearing a t-shirt. If you know where this guy is, call Crime Stoppers, 498-STOP. You could always remain anonymous. There is now a $3,000 reward available for tips that lead to the arrest of Andrew Garcia. And if the allegations, as explained here by the Fresno Police Department, are correct, an individual who very, very richly deserves to be arrested and prosecuted.
So they asked the victim what had happened, and he said he didn't know the suspect and hadn't seen him before. He said he didn't want me being happy. That's what he wanted. He didn't want me having a good time. I have one thing to say to that guy. You had no right to hit me like you did. I did nothing to you, and why'd you have to?